gonna first do his direct action song.
People gonna rise like the water. We gonna face this crisis now.
I hear the voice of my great granddaughter. Keep it in the ground.
Come on now.
Good evening, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. Today, my guest is Daryl Molina Sarmiento, Executive Director for Communities for a Better Environment, a 40-year-old environmental justice organization with offices in both Southern and Northern California. We're going to talk about CBE's activities and the general topic of environmental justice. Daryl Molina Sarmiento, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're welcome. So why don't we start with some history? When and where was Communities for a Better Environment founded? And how did it reach California?
Great. Yes. Yeah, so Communities for a Better Environment actually first started as Citizens for a Better Environment out in Chicago. And it formally moved and expanded to California in 1978 in San Francisco. And that's when we essentially became our own independent 501c3 in the state of California. And around the late 80s, early 90s is when we expanded and also opened up our offices in Southern California, in Los Angeles. And so essentially for 40 plus years now, CBE has been here doing our work in California.
And what are the missions and goals of CBE?
Sure. So CBE, we are a environmental justice organization. We have in-house scientists, in-house legal, and in-house community organizers that work together to advance environmental justice through our organizing, power building, and alliance building. Essentially, you know, especially now, we've really been defining it under the term or the framework of a just transition, which essentially is a lot of the work that CBE has been doing for decades now of, you know, stopping the bad polluting industries and building the new towards a healthy, sustainable, regenerative economy that are good for both our communities and for the workers.
Okay. Now, I saw from the website you've been with CBE since 2005. And I was wondering how you got started and, you know, what your background in education, what in your background in education made you decide to sign up?
Yeah, I have been with the organization for many years, starting in 2005. So this is my 15th year with CBE. But actually, my first time encountering CBE was when I was in college, a student at UCLA, a freshman. I took an environmental course, and that is when I had the opportunity to attend my first toxic tour with Communities for a Better Environment. And essentially, that tour is, you know, taking you on various sites in the community that has been impacted by environmental racism and how the community organized against that. And that was my first exposure to CBE. And years later, I was able to apply for the youth program coordinator position. And I was in that role for 6 years. And then I also became our Southern California program director after that for another 6 years before transitioning into this role of executive director. But for me, I mean, I'm definitely personally connected to the work of CBE. My family is from the Philippines. I was born and raised here, but, you know, having the opportunity to go back, my dad's village is a coastal community, and we have a seawall. And every year, the typhoon intensity increases, and that seawall has come down year after year after year. So climate change is very real for me and my family, and the work that we do here locally, I know, has global impacts. And, you know, what we're facing here is, you know, what many communities, many people are facing all over the world.
So, you know, I'm sure many of our listeners know what environmental justice is, but maybe you can define it and explain why low-income and minorities community experience greater exposure to environmental pollutants than wealthier white ones.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the basic concept of environmental justice is like, we all want our children to grow up in a clean and safe environment. It is a basic human right to breathe clean air, to drink clean water, where we go to school, where we live, where we work, where we play, regardless of the color of our skin, regardless of how much money we make, regardless of our abilities, our nationality. We, you know, this is a right that we're trying to protect for everyone. And unfortunately, there are communities that are disproportionately impacted by environmental injustices. And what we see in these communities, like the communities in which CBE organizes in, are high rates of asthma, high rates of cancer, high rates of respiratory diseases, and premature death, because we are in such close proximity to a high concentration of polluting sources. And those polluting sources stem from freeways, oil refineries, oil drilling, crematoriums, steel plating facilities, any type of toxic facilities. We know that, and it is well documented, that there is a higher concentration of these in communities where people are low income and where there are people of color. I mean, in the state of California, we have even the Cal Enviro Screen, which we've had to actually fight for the creation of an actual tool to be able to measure, to weigh various socioeconomic stressors and layer that onto factors around race, factors around income. And we can see very clearly that there are communities like Southeast LA, like Wilmington, that are in the highest rates of environmental and pollution risk in the state and in the country. And we, and so we're fighting for our right to live in a healthy and safe community, no matter, you know, where you live and what you look like.
What you mentioned, California Enviro Screen. Is that some kind of on-site tool, or is it something else?
It's a tool that was created at the statewide level that gives legislators and policymakers a way to measure and a way to direct where resources need to go, where we need to actually put even stronger protections for communities that have been overburdened historically because of structural racism that exists. So, you know, communities are, you know, again, like certain communities are disproportionately sided with these polluting industries, and that helps to kind of officially make that a way in order for us to address those issues.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of pursue this question about the structural injustice and racism.
Yes.
Because it's built into the infrastructure of the society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one question which is sometimes a sort of a touchy one is, you know, which came first, the infrastructure or the community? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen arguments that because of, you know, people moving in and out, that communities were located near factories, you know, and workers moved out to the suburbs, and then low income people moved in behind them, right? But I mean, the factories were polluting. So there's a sense in which it's possible that the pollution came first, right? And I'm not arguing, you know, that somehow that excuses the pollution. Then on the other hand, when you have the freeways, you know, the freeways were built much later, right? Were freeways built deliberately through low-income and minority communities, for example?
Yeah, right, exactly. I think, you know, if you just look at urban history of urban planning, history of how cities were designed and made, and the discriminatory practices when it comes to housing, mm-hmm. and who is allowed to live where,
right?
And discriminatory zoning practices that are complementary to those housing, you know, where people are allowed to live. And so those, the historical injustices that have really led to this current condition. And currently, even when we have been able to fight for an environmental protection, it's not even enforced. And facilities that are currently permitted have weak permits. And so the permits that they're granted are weak and have very, very little protection for anybody living near it. And then those permits aren't even enforced. And on top of that, even if they are violated, they may just get a simple slap on the wrist and they get to pay the fine and continue to pollute. And so you have just this compounding crisis of this structural inequity, this lack of enforcement, and then communities, when we go to our regulators, I can't breathe. That is not at all valued, you know. You know, historically, like, we have to like prove that we are being impacted by the pollution that is in our neighborhood, and that burden is being put on communities, and oftentimes we're also not listened to or ignored, even when that happens. And we have so many examples, you know, from Exide and others that we can talk about.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell us about Exide? I mean, I've seen it in the papers recently, and I saw some information on the website. What exactly is that?
Yeah, so Exide is a lead battery recycling. It's a battery recycling facility. It's an international company. And one of its facilities is located in Southeast Los Angeles, which is, you know, on the bordering Boyle Heights, the city, which is part of the city of LA, and then the small cities within Southeast LA, Commerce, Huntington Park, Vernon, Southgate, all of these Boyle Heights neighboring cities are, which are high concentration of people. You know, there's over 100,000 residents that live, you know, within miles of this facility. Mm-hmm. And year after year, this is, again, an example of a facility that has been operating under a temporary permit for decades. So it has been allowed to operate with, you know, like, you know, not a good permitting situation. And then on top of it, it continued to violate environmental law after another, and it continued to pay its fines. It took years and years of the community organizing to actually get this facility to shut down. And it wasn't even through our state agencies. We had to go to the U.S. Attorney's office to get this facility to shut down permanently, and that was in 2015. And that was, again, like I said, a massive organizing effort to get our local elected officials on the side of the community when the community knew already that we are being contaminated by lead and arsenic. Mm-hmm. So this facility has had egregious violations, releasing high levels of lead, which is, you know, obviously very damaging in any form, at any dose of exposure, and arsenic, which is cancer causing. And so most recently, we had to fight for millions of dollars in order to get that site cleaned up. So not only did we have to fight for it to get shut down, then we had to fight for it to get cleaned up. the funds that we had to, that we were able to get for the cleanup were not enough.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, less than 10% of the homes that were, you know, exposed to this lead contamination were cleaned up. And so what was prioritized are homes with young children, homes with women that are pregnant. These are the homes that got cleaned up, but what about all of the other schools, parkways, that still have all this contamination? And then on top of that, what just happened this year is the facility filed for bankruptcy.
Right.
And unfortunately, the bankruptcy court ruled in favor of Exide Technologies, allowing them to abandon their shutdown recycling plant, leaving this massive cleanup of lead and other toxic pollutants of, in the surrounding neighborhoods to us, the California taxpayers.
Jesus.
And it is it's really, you know, it's hard to have words for what just happened. You know, our young people in our youth program have grown up fighting against Exide, and now they see another failure of the system. And Exide is getting away with this, and we're being forced to foot the bill and to clean up its mess and to figure out what needs to happen next. And so, unfortunately, like, you know, we put up a valiant fight, and it's a failure on multiple levels, from the Department of Toxic Substance Control to the US EPA to the Department of Justice. It's just a real travesty on behalf of the thousands of residents and future generations that are going to be impacted by this massive cleanup, by this massive disaster. And so that is why we need to continue to keep fighting, keep organizing. You know, we tried this year to reform the Department of Toxic Substance Control, and to because of these sad and terrible cases like Exide, we are fighting for accountability from our elected officials. And unfortunately, you know, we tried to pass a law to do that with DTSC, but it got vetoed by Governor Newsom this year. And so we're, we're trying to find the regulatory, the policy fixes to support the on-the-ground organizing that we've been doing for decades to protect our communities, to protect the health of our children and our basic right to live in a clean environment.
Let's take a short break here.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Good evening. This is Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Daryl Molina Sarmiento, Director of Citizens for a Better Environment.
Okay. Is this first of all, what's going to happen with this site? What's the cleanup cost and who takes responsibility? I mean, surely the community itself isn't expected to do something about the...
Yeah. I mean, we're even talking, you know, we have in LA County, we have a new, we voted out our DA.
Yeah.
And we have a new DA coming on. And so... Gaston, and you know, he's been a huge champion. He actually invited us to an environmental justice transition team to talk about like what are his day one priorities. So we're really using all of the opportunities to see like from the legal side to the policy side, mm-hmm. what are ways that we can not only get more money for the cleanup, but like right now there was a battery tax law that was passed that's supposed to help fund the cleanup. So every car battery sold in California is taxed, and that tax will go towards, a fund for cleanup for facilities like Exide. But, you know, it's also still not enough.
Do you know how much, what the estimated cost of cleanup is? I'm just wondering, what's the ballpark?
I don't know right now off the top of my head. I can locate that information,
That's okay.
Okay.
Well, I know that you've had a number of legal successes, and I'm wondering if you might be able to tell us about some of those.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think the most recent success that I would want to point to is in the last few years, we've really been working on the issue of neighborhood oil drilling. And you know, before we even started our campaign with Stand LA, which we can talk about later, you know, our members brought to our attention the Warren oil drilling facility, Warren E&P. And this is the largest oil drilling operation on the West Coast. It's located in the neighborhood of Wilmington, which is, you know, right by the Port of LA and Long Beach, in the city of LA. And that oil drilling facility was operating 24 hours a day, had a flare on 24 hours a day. You know, the neighbors described it as a living hell. And the work on that oil drilling facility made us realize that this is just like one facility out of hundreds in the small neighborhood of Wilmington. And we realized that there's actually an over-concentration of oil drilling sites in the community of Wilmington and the community of South LA. And so what our, you know, through the work of our legal team and our researchers, we found out that there has been a pattern and practice of rubber stamping oil drilling in low-income communities of color, specifically within the city of Los Angeles. And so you have neighborhoods, more affluent neighborhoods on the west side of LA that have enclosed oil drilling sites. They don't even look like an oil drilling site. Really? They look like a building. They operate on electric rigs. They're not operating 24 hours a day. If you look at an oil drilling site in Wilmington, it's right next to a home, fully exposed, bordered by a chain link fence. You can see it outside of your, out of your window when you're washing the dishes. Diesel rig, trucks going in and out 24 hours a day. And if you just drive by, it's just like, you know, going up and down all day long. And so we sued the city of LA for its pattern and practice of rubber stamping oil drilling sites and not going through a full, like CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act process before permitting of these sites. And the city settled and they actually changed their permitting process so that there aren't these disparities in how they're siting these oil drilling facilities in one neighborhood versus another. The interesting part, so that was a victory, but what happened was the California Independent Petroleum Association sued us. They countersued the city and Communities for a Better Environment. We brought the lawsuit actually on behalf of our youth program, Youth for Environmental Justice. So you see CIPA, the California Independent Petroleum Association, sued Youth for Environmental Justice for asserting our rights to protect our community and to work with the city of LA. And basically they tried to recover nearly $700,000 in legal fees from our small nonprofit organization. They, and so this is what we call a slap suit, an anti-slap suit. And for the, this is the first time in decades that CBE was able to beat the, you know, a retaliatory suit of that kind brought upon young people living in Wilmington next to fossil fuel industry.
It, I mean, it would seem like an opportune time to shut down oil drilling in the LA basin. They can't be producing that much oil. These must be like stripper wells, you know, few barrels a day. It's kind of incomprehensible to me that that's being allowed, but
and that was just, and really that legal victory paved the way for us to take deeper strides and actually push for, like what you're saying, a phase out of oil drilling because of its incompatibility you know, with where people live. And so we actually did, after that legal, or, you know, while we were fighting for that legal victory, we've been also fighting for a policy solution, mm-hmm. which originally was a 2,500-foot buffer zone between oil drilling operations and sensitive receptors.
Yeah.
But what we were able to actually win very recently, a couple of weeks ago, through, again, like many, many years of organizing, was we were able to get the city to pass a motion directing the city attorney's office to declare oil and gas extraction non-conforming land uses.
Oh.
So essentially, it will phase out oil drilling within the city of LA. This is the first step towards phasing out oil drilling entirely in the city of LA, which is amazing, amazing victory and precedent setting for any other community to follow.
So that's what Stand LA is involved in?
Yes, right. That's right.
And what is it then, Stand LA? It's
sure. So Stand LA came to, so I talked about our legal victory and quickly transitioned into our Stand LA victory, but Stand LA is our Stand Together Against Neighborhood Drilling coalition, made up of our various partner organizations in the city of LA, from PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, to Scope, to Redeemer, to Holman United Church, and all of our Black Women for Wellness and others. And all of our organizations have one thing in common, is that there is this high concentration of oil drilling in our neighborhoods. And our motto is, no drilling where we're living. It's very simple. And we have been, you know, running on that and trying to push for a just transition of these 300 jobs that would be impacted by the phase out of oil drilling in the city of LA. And so this is a huge opportunity for us to make a case study and show the success of how we were able to transition the city of LA away from oil drilling.
What's, do you have some kind of, you know, strategy then for providing these jobs? And, you know, you're talking about a just transition. And I assume that's focused on things like renewable energy, and so what's your plan?
Yes, it's focused on renewable energy, but it's also very specifically about, so we want to support the fossil fuel workers, to be able to transition into other jobs and other industries as these oil wells are being phased out. And, you know, we've been working in the city for many, many years on energy just general energy democracy issues and clean energy issues. We've worked on the LA Sustainability Plan, the LA Green New Deal. We're part of the we're part of many coalitions within the city of Los Angeles, Repower LA, LA Clean Energy Coalition, and others, to advance and to ensure that we're reaching our clean energy targets within the city, which, you know, essentially what's been happening is we have been able to advance clean energy targets, but at the same time, fossil fuels continue to expand and get permitted in the city of LA. And so we are reaching our climate goals, and we're still increasing fossil fuel usage. And so that's why we're trying to push back against the fossil fuel side. We've been successful on kind of we continue to work on our advocating for clean energy, and at the same time, you know, stopping the increase of permitting of old technology fossil fuels that are keeping us stuck in these cycles.
You mentioned a couple of things, and I wanted to just pursue them. You mentioned the term energy democracy. What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's really like this basic concept of democratically controlled local energy systems. And it's like a larger, it's like a general terminology, but it's the work that we've been doing for many, many decades to push us away from reliance on fossil fuels. So when in the community in Southeast Los Angeles, for example, during my time as in my time at CBE, I've had to work on two campaigns. We've had to work on two campaigns to stop the construction of natural gas power plants here in the city. And so even just that basic understanding that we can fulfill our energy needs in clean and healthier ways than building another power plant, you know, has been part of that fight.
And then there was something about the LA Green New Deal. And I had a question later about, you know, how you view the Green New Deal more generally.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the term Green New Deal has been used like at the national level, at the local level, at the statewide level. And, you know, for us, like, it's a framework, it's a policy framework. And, you know, we just, you know, CBE and organizations like CBE and the environmental justice and climate justice movement, we've been fighting for this for decades. And we're glad that it's getting traction under this framework. So whatever it is that we call it, whether that's Green New Deal or just transition or just recovery, for us, what's really important is to ensure that these policies are grounded in the leadership and the expertise of the frontline communities that are, you know, living it on the daily basis, and that we are not only at the table, but we are designing these policies so that it actually serves our communities and brings in the resources that we need to make this transition. And you know, we've also want to push back against false solutions, like this terminology we call false solutions. So there are, you know, we like to say that transition is inevitable, but justice is not. And so we need to push for the justice piece of this within the Green New Deal and ensure that whatever those policy solutions are going to actually support and help our communities and not add continued harm. There are false solutions that we consider, such as cap and trade, these market-based mechanisms to address climate change that, you know, at a larger scale, you know, it, maybe you might see reduction, but what's actually happening is we're creating an over-concentration of pollution in low-income communities because the facilities that our communities have 5 oil refineries in them. And so we're actually seeing an increase of emissions from these refineries at the local level that is impacting our health. And so we don't want to see, you know, these market-based solutions that actually won't bring the justice that we need. We want to see the just transition. We want to see the phase out. We want to see the direct emissions reductions. Communities have been fighting for these things for decades. And, again, like, no matter what the term is, the policy term is, like, these are still the same basics that we've been fighting for.
Well, let's take a short break.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Good evening. This is Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Daryl Molina Sarmiento, Director of Citizens for a Better Environment.
Okay. So, you know, the radio station is in Northern California. So I'm wondering, you know, what kind of work you're engaged in Oakland and Richmond. Maybe you could describe some of that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, historically, you know, CBE has, we started off in Northern California, San Francisco, Bay Area. We've, you know, historically we've had massive groundbreaking wins around oil refinery regulation in the San Francisco Bay Area. We, you know, CBE has been instrumental and lead around campaigns around the Hunters Point power plant, Potrero power plant, and so, you know, like these facilities, industrial power plant facilities, oil refineries in the Bay Area, such as Chevron in Richmond.
Right.
Like, we've been working around regulating and phasing out and decommissioning these these sites for decades now. Yeah. More, you know, more recently in East Oakland, we've been really focusing on the toxic, individual toxic facilities that are impacting our neighborhoods. We have a high concentration of some of the biggest polluters in the country, massive polluters that are right in our neighborhoods. And one of them is a metal foundry called ABNI. Another is a crematorium. And so we've been really trying to do the work with our members to not only like monitor and track, but also like think about how do we want to phase these types of facilities out of our community so that we can breathe clean air. We've also been really engaged on the policy level around implementing these emissions reduction plans that have been part of AB 617, which is the law that was passed a few years back that is going to allow communities to address the pollution in their neighborhoods. And so we've been also working on that plan for East Oakland. And on the clean energy side, we've had the opportunity of passing at the statewide level these laws such as SOMA, Solar on Multifamily Housing.
Yeah.
So CBE helped like design and pass this law, and now we're in the implementation phase about solar energy installations on top of low income housing, multifamily right. housing. Mm-hmm. And so we've been reaching out to residents in the community around how we can support them in reducing their energy bills and the residents. And, you know, this is a time of pandemic. This is a time of, COVID crisis compounding with the climate crisis. And so we really had to be very active around supporting the communities most impacted by COVID and by wildfires. And so mm-hmm. we've been doing a lot of, community response to that, putting together wildfire kits, especially for a lot of the unhoused residents in East Oakland to help just like support and just provide some relief because, it's the organizations on the ground, the ones that actually organize with the residents that are there, that are listening, that can provide resources that they may not be able to access otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
In Richmond, we're still actively working around the just transition, essentially, of like transitioning our community, our economy from, this extractive economy and towards a more regenerative economy. And so that part of that has been really around looking at Chevron and its influence in the region and what is that plan that we can start now. We have to start now if you want to see it decommission years down the line. And so even from like a narrative point of view, we've been like working with our young people about seeing this relationship with refineries like Chevron. It's a toxic relationship.
Sure.
The school, sure. Richmond High School, the mascot is an oil can. they're called the Oilers.
Yeah, well.
And so it's, and so these are, just even these like basic realities that the young people grow up under, like how do we change that narrative? How do we move away from a community dependent on this fossil fuel industry and change that story? So these are, some of the things that we've been working on in the Bay Area.
Do you
and there's much more, but
Do you get involved in regulatory proceedings and the like? I mean, obviously you're doing, yes. you're lobbying for legislation, right? And you're working locally, but a lot of this ends up being about the regulatory agencies. So do you intervene there?
Yeah, we're very, Yes, absolutely. We're currently one of the rules that we're working on is the cat cracker rule at the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, which is a very specific piece of refinery equipment.
Uh-huh.
But if we are able to pass this regulation, then we will have, one of the strongest oil refinery regulations in the country. And again, like a lot of times this work is very technical, we have to fight for every little bit, from pushing the refinery to use the clean technology that is available to them that they refuse to use, just every detail, every little bit. We have an organizing campaign around, and we have to break down that language so that our members can speak directly to the regulators and tell them the truth and demand that accountability.
Do they listen? Not your members, the commissioners.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we've fought really hard to get to the point where we're at today. The governor just announced yesterday that he is appointing Gideon Krakoff to the California Air Resources Board. Mm-hmm. He's going to be one of the newest board members at CARB, at ARB, is one of the biggest, governing bodies in the state of California. And Gideon is as an environmental justice lawyer. He was on CBE's board. He was our board president many years ago. We had to fight for him to get on the seat at the South Coast Air Quality Management District. And now he represents us at South Coast and at CARB. Mm-hmm. And so, they're listening because our people are there now.
Yeah.
Now we're telling them who needs to be the ones voting. Mm-hmm. It's our people. And so we've made a lot of headway to have the governor listen to us and put the people we want in those roles. But oftentimes they still will put a former Exxon, staffer in these roles, or people that have worked against clean energy and climate justice and environmental justice in these roles. And so, when that we try to be ahead of that. And if not, we push back against that and then mm-hmm. ensure that, mm-hmm. The right people are in these decision-making roles.
So, I mean, I guess that's a victory, isn't it? Getting him on CARB. I did see the announcement, but I didn't know he was he'd been an environmental justice lawyer. Let's see. Somewhere along the way, I also saw this mention of citizen science. Do you still do that? Can you explain what that is? And because that's sort of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, citizen science, I feel like that's kind of we don't really use that term as much anymore. We usually mainly use a term like participatory action research.
Right, right.
Yeah. That's one of the ways that we talk about it. But essentially it's, the people that live on the ground have, they're the experts. They're the experts, and we actually need to work with them to develop, the research needs to come from them. Like they're we need to ground truth. They are ground truthing, whatever policy is being put in place. And so, historically CBE has put out a lot of, research, because we have, it's all in-house for us, our research, we have staff, scientists and research and policy staff, along with our organizing staff, and that is how we create policies like the CalEnviro screen, is because of what we call citizen science. So one example is some early origins of CalEnviro screen was there are state databases that say here are the polluting industries in your neighborhood. We got that list, and I worked with the youth that I was organizing at the time, and mm-hmm. we walked the block and we looked at the address and we said, is that facility there? Yes. actually they did this. This isn't on the list. And this is also not on the list, or this mm-hmm. address is wrong. And so we ground truth, what is knowledge that is supposedly out there. And so, I mean, that's just one example of it. Another example more recently is like we partnered with USC to put air monitoring, to arm our youth with air monitoring devices. And so they had a backpack and, you know, captured this data that, you know, will hopefully lead to stronger regulations. There's a lot of various examples about how, you know, I've done work, we've done truck counting, we've monitored particulate matter close to our schools, you know, and we could do community air monitoring, bucket brigades, where we build a bucket, a DIY bucket, which is an air sampling tool that we then are able to send these air samples to be analyzed to know what is in our air. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to, you know, bring these tools and these strategies, and other communities have been able to use and take advantage of that. And, you know, we do air monitoring logs and collect data around emissions from the facilities that are right next to us. So when we go to the regulators, we can say, like, here's my log of, I smelled this at this time. I smelled this at this time. This is what's coming out. And, you know, and this real life data is what, unfortunately, is needed sometimes to prove to the regulators that they actually need to take action, that people are being impacted. And, you know, and the research must be for the community. It has to be for the community to benefit and serve the community, mm-hmm. as opposed to them as subjects of this research.
Sure. Yeah.
Driven by and done by our members.
Do you do any curriculum development around those kinds of things?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. We do a lot, you know, a lot of our organizations, similar to CBE, we have curriculum development. That is a key piece to how we do our work, is for folks to understand it themselves and to and to do it themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take another short break.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Good evening. This is Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Daryl Molina Sarmiento, Director of Citizens for a Better Environment.
Do you think that the you know, the environment for your kind of work will become more supportive under the new administration? I mean, what is your sort of view of what is, you know, likely to happen or what may happen once Biden and Harris take over?
Yeah. Well, you know, with Trump, we had to deal with climate deniers,
right.
A rollback of, you know, laws and things that we've fought for, you know, for decades. And so, you know, from that standpoint, you know, we don't have to be fully on the defense all the time. We can actually push. Now we have an opportunity now to fight for what we want instead of like holding on to what we had, or even just fighting for like the basic recognition of science. And so in that sense, definitely there's an opportunity. You know, we've already been we've been weighing in on Biden's pick for US EPA administrator. You know, there are you know, what is our input on that, and I think that in itself is really important, that we have access to this administration in ways that we, you know, we did not have with this last administration. I think like the part for us that we would want to push back again is against or challenges that we may encounter is like what I mentioned before around these false solutions that may be pushed forth at the national level when it comes to environmental and climate issues at the national level, is that more of a neoliberal approach maybe taken under the new administration, and we would want to, you know, push back and make sure that, again, we don't want the false solutions to the environmental and climate crisis. We want grounded solutions around just transition. We don't want geoengineering as like the only solution, or you know, policies such as cap and trade or transportation climate initiative on the East Coast, and these policies that harm EJ communities. And so I think that's what we're going to be having to take on in this new administration.
It just occurred to me, a question just occurred to me. So LA is laced with freeways, right? And covered with gasoline fueled cars. Do you imagine that a move towards electric vehicles is going to, you know, make a significant difference in the kinds of exposures and impacts that we've been talking about?
No, that's fine. You know, actually, CVE has been working on electrification of transportation, or decarbonizing transportation, for many years. For us in California, because it's inevitable that, you know, the electrification is happening, but what's happening is that equity is not at all part of the equation.
Right.
That, you know, the benefits of, you know, clean energy, clean electricity, clean transportation are not at all getting towards the people being most impacted by environmental injustices and the fossil fuel companies.
Yeah.
So we are fighting, even at that level, we fight for the equity piece within clean transportation, within that clean transportation system, to ensure not only access, but that, you know, we make sure that there isn't injustice in the way that, you know, these new technologies are rolling out as well.
And how do you make, you know, how do you ensure that?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of detail that I'm sure our policy, you know, we have a lot of information on our website, cdcal.org, but also, you know, it's like from who's considered low income?
Mm-hmm.
What is the amount of rebate? Should there be higher rebates for low-income communities of color? You know, just like what are the, just creating any incentive and benefit program to allow access to this technology. Where are the charging stations? We need charging stations in our community. So we have been able to, if groups like CB didn't get it involved, it would be even much worse. It's still bad. There's a massive divide in access in how this is rolling out. It is still, you know, somewhat controversial as well, in terms of a solution, and it's not the only solution by any means. We want a you know, fossil fuel free transportation overall, you know, when mm-hmm, it comes to mm-hmm. the goods movement, not just you know, individual families and vehicles, but there's public transportation, there's goods movement, there's a lot that is part of this larger clean transportation conversation, and that's EVs is one part of it.
Is there anything else you might want to bring up before we wrap up the show?
Yeah, I mean, I think For the listeners, like the work that, you know, while CVE is very much, you know, localized within Southeast LA, Wilmington, East Oakland, and Richmond, like the work that we do really impacts all of us in California. We're reducing greenhouse gases by preventing the expansion and the permitting of these massive fossil fuel industries from mm-hmm. coming in and fueling more to our climate crisis, the COVID crisis, the wildfire crisis. We know that our communities are also hit harder by the pandemic. Like COVID rates are actually, it's, you know, the linkage between pollution and COVID is clear. And in addition to the compounding crisis of, you know, systemic racism, we're just being hit hard. And so, you know, our communities are strong. Our members are strong. We're, there's a lot of environmental justice communities and movements in California and nationally with CEHA, the California Environmental Justice Alliance, the Climate Justice Alliance at the national level. There's a lot of groups and people and doing this work. And so we've had a lot of challenges. We've had a lot of massive disasters, like, you know, Richmond still continues to flare, even during the pandemic. Exide, we talked about Exide, but
yeah.
we're fighting, and you know, we're really pushing for a new vision for our communities, for our survival, for our resilience, and yeah, I'm just very happy to be here and share the work that we're doing, and really invite people to learn more and to get involved and to support this important work.
Okay, well, listen, thank you so much, Daryl, for being on Sustainability Now.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
And I if anyone wants to learn more about Communities for a Better Environment and its work, you can look it up on the internet.
As you may have read in a number of places, not only is the ocean full of plastic, we're literally living in an ocean of plastic microparticles falling from the sky. Before you know it, we will all be plastic people of the universe. On Sunday, December 29th, we will take up this topic. My guest will be Kevin Bell, co-founder and co-director of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation in Santa Cruz, which is not coincidentally also the underwriter for this program. Bell has been conducting research into the plastics recycling dilemma and the diffusion of plastic through the environment, and also looking for ways to make sure that takeout containers and utensils are truly biodegradable and compostable. That's Sunday, December 29th, 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org on the internet. As a reminder, shows from the 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m., and you can hear previous shows at KSQD.org/sustainabilitynow and various podcast sites. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Emily Donham for today's engineering and to everyone else at the station who makes KSQD your community radio station. Until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
We're gonna first do this direct action song. The people gonna rise like the water.
The people gonna rise like the water.
We gonna face this crisis now.
We're gonna face this crisis now.
I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter.
I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter.
Saying keep it in the ground.
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 The people gonna rise like the water. We gonna face this crisis now.
I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter. Saying keep it in the ground.
Come on now. The people gonna rise like the water. We gonna face this crisis now. I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter.
Then
one more time. The people gonna rise like the water. We gonna face this crisis now. I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter.
The people gonna rise like water.